It's a marshmallow world in the winter when the snow comes to cover the ground.
Have you ever heard about the marshmallow test? We will find out what it teaches us about personal finances during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network, plus financial planner Kevin McKinley will also have information and advice on slow money, using IRAs for nursing home expenses, and meal services. Are they worth the cost? And as always, we invite your money-related questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
You know, it's not every day that I get to start off the show with Marshmallow World by Dean Martin. And I rather liked it. But there was a study that was done several decades ago that might provide some insight into personal finance pitfalls that we experience today and maybe even in the future. So tell us about the marshmallow test, Kevin.
The marshmallow test was conducted at Stanford University by a psychologist named Walter Mischel during the 1960s and 70s. And what he did is He sat down with individual preschool children in a study room and placed a marshmallow in front of the kids. And they said, you can eat this marshmallow now if you want. But if you don't eat it, I will come back here in a little while and I will give you another marshmallow so you can have two.
Well, I know if that was chocolate, what would happen if I was doing this. But
he wouldn't even get to finish the sentence.
But what were the results of this one?
Well, they went back and they studied the kids that they could find. There were about 500 kids that they did study, and they circled back and got to almost 100 of them later in life. And they found that the ones who had actually waited so that they could get the second marshmallow did much better later in life in terms of school, by their SAT scores and grade, their work, their happiness, even their BMI was lower relative to the kids who said, and took the first one they could get their hands on.
Isn't that something? Delayed gratification. So can we see the benefits of saving later instead of spending now?
Yes, whether it's saving for retirement and going to college. You know, a lot of people automatically go to college, but when you're confronted with that decision, especially if money is tight, you have to think that not only are you spending the money on college tuition and living expenses, but you also are giving up earnings that you could otherwise get if you were to go out in the full-time adult world. And also talking about spending too much money on declining assets like a car or something that's too expensive for you to drive, and paying cash whenever possible rather than buying something and putting it on a credit card, and then having much bigger bills later on and paying much more for the item in the form of higher interest costs down the road than he would if he were to just pay cash for it. But it also demonstrates it's a bigger point that was made by the researcher and that doesn't get a lot of attention.
And what is that?
It's how important it is that the subject trust that that second marshmallow is coming. It's not just about your own internal ability to delay gratification or discipline. It's about, do you honestly believe that the researcher, administrator of the test is going to actually come back to you with that second marshmallow? And it relates back to education, saving, taking care of yourself so that you can live longer, and even delaying Social Security and investing in the stock market. There was another follow-up study in 2012 at the University of Rochester that actually confirmed it, that said that the bigger indicator of whether or not people would wait for that second marshmallow to come was if they were sure that the marshmallow was coming. The more that they trusted the administrator, the more that they would likely to wait for it. So our institutions, government, society, the economy, people need to trust that there will be two marshmallows in the bush. Otherwise, they will just eat the one that's in their hand.
So would you wait for that second marshmallow, or would you eat the marshmallow in your hand? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney at WPR.org. We welcome your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And let's take a call from Sally in Appleton. Hi, Sally.
Hello, good morning. I have a question for Kevin. I make six figures right now, and aside from adjusting the W-2s to avoid having to pay taxes at the end of the year, what else would you suggest that I do?
Well, congratulations, Sally, and by making six figures, you mean not including the decimal point, right?
Correct.
Okay, good. Good for you. Well, let me ask you this, Sally. At your job, they obviously have some kind of retirement plan for you, correct?
Yes.
Okay, are you maxing out the retirement savings options in that plan?
No, not right now.
Okay, what's keeping you from doing that?
I'm probably just unawareness of what else I can do.
Okay, that is by far and away the best thing that you can do. Are you under 50 years old, Sally?
Yes.
Okay. You can save, usually in most plans, you can save up to $18,000 per year of your pre-tax earnings into a 401k. And when you do that, Sally, are you single or married?
Married.
Okay, I'm not hitting on you. I'm asking for tax purposes.
Fair.
Since you're married, does your spouse have earned income as well?
No, he avoided that because we started to have to pay more when he was working.
Okay. So, you can probably save roughly 20 to 30 cents in taxes for every dollar that you put into that 401k. And you're not spending it on anything. You're not donating it to a charity. You're not investing it in a business. You're just moving it from, it would otherwise go into your bank account, and you're sliding it over into the 401k. So if you put $10,000 into the 401k, which, by the way, on average, people should try to save about $5,000 per person per year into their retirement account, especially in their 20s and 30s, obviously more as you get older. But if you can just slide $10,000 into that 401k, it'll seem tough at first because you'll notice the drop in the size of your paycheck. But come April 15th of the following year, you will save, again, $2,000 to $3,000 in taxes. And that money is still all yours, and it's not gone. You may be able to access it via a loan from the 401k. You'll definitely be able to get at it in retirement. And sometimes you can even get at it in hardship cases, although you will have to pay taxes and maybe a penalty on the distribution. That's far and away the best way to do it. Other ways that you can consider taking taxes off in return for funding things are putting money into an HSA, a health savings account, which we're going to be talking about that in a few weeks. If you fund one of those, you not only get a tax break on your deposits, but you usually have a lower premium cost for your health insurance. Do you know if you have an HSA available at work, Sally?
We do not.
Okay. And then finally, if you have kids, there are dependent accounts that you can fund money in. There are flexible spending accounts that allow you to put money aside in for pre-tax dollars and then use it for qualified expenses. And when you pull it out, there are no taxes to it. But the tricky thing with those other accounts, especially the flexible spending accounts, is it's a use it or lose it proposition, meaning if you put the money in there, you get a tax break on it. But often you have to use it within a relatively short period of time, about a year after you put the money in. And so if you don't use it for the qualified expenses, you can lose it. But other than that, please, please, please start with the 401k. Do the best you can and know that you can always go back and say, gee, this is really hurting us financially on a paycheck-to-paycheck basis. You can change the withholding amount so that not quite as much money is coming out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. Good luck to you. Time now for an email. And boy, this listener is really laying it on thick, Kevin.
Why we're taking it.
A listener named Sue writes, Kevin, you are the best ever, the king of financial advice, Big Lee. as in big league, I believe. My mother recently went to a nursing home to the tune of $6,500 a month. I need to take money out of her IRA to fund the experience. What would be the wisest way to ensure we pay the minimal taxes? Any advice you can provide would be greatly appreciated. And she signs it by saying she is your biggest fan in Dubuque.
That's saying something, because I have a lot of big fans.
That's right.
In Dubuque. $6,500, by the way, is about the average cost of a nursing home. And according to the Center for Retirement Research, the average stay for a male in a nursing home is about 11 months, and the average stay for a female is about 17 months. And about 44% of men go into a nursing home, and about 58% of women go into a nursing home. And typically that's because in a couple with a male and a female, the male usually dies first or he gets sicker first, so the woman is more likely to be there to care for him. She is less likely to have someone else to do the same for her. So let's talk about the best way to fund this. She should definitely take it out on an as-needed basis rather than doing it all at once. And the reason being is that she can then manage the distributions not only as she sees fit for her mother, but she avoids taking a big tax hit by just saying, well, we're going to need 100 grand this year, or whatever they think they're going to need, and pulling it all out at once and paying the taxes on it, and then finding out maybe they didn't need as much. It's difficult to get that toothpaste back into the proverbial tube.
Yeah, so Sue wanted to know the wisest way.
The wisest amount is whatever is needed, and keeping the taxable income as low as possible, and especially if she can keep it in the 15% federal income tax bracket. For a single person in 2017, that's probably about $50,000 of gross income, and once you boil it down to the line 43 on the 1040, which is where the actual tax rate is determined, you're probably looking at about $37,000 or so, again, for 2017.
How bad is the tax bill likely to be?
Well, let's see. She needs $6,500, so that's about $78,000 a year after taxes, and that probably works into $90,000 of gross income, give or take. They're going to get a little break because I'm assuming she's going to get some Social Security as well. And according to the H&R Block calculator that we use, she's probably going to owe about $15,000 of federal income taxes on getting that $90,000 out. But it is possible to deduct the nursing home expenses to the extent it qualifies as medical care. And depending on how much of those expenses do qualify, she could avoid the taxes almost completely, almost the way down to nothing on that. If she looks at publication 502 at IRS.gov, that's publication 502 at IRS.gov. She can get a better idea of what expenses in a nursing home actually qualify for nursing home or for medical expenses, and then how to take the break. And we'll have a link up to publication 502 at IRS.gov at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and we will take more of your personal finance questions for him in just a bit. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a money matter you'd like to run by Kevin. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Gotta get me some dollars and cents, dollars and cents. Them greenback bills with the pictures of the president.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. We welcome your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Back to the phones, and Jim in Green Bay is our next caller. Hello, Jim.
Hi. My mother recently passed away, and she left us an IRA that is all in stock. My brother and I are beneficiaries, and I'm 65 and he's 60. Is there a way of having the stockbroker who's holding the IRA transfer this IRA to a charity so he can avoid paying taxes?
So you just want to have it disclaimed to a charity, correct?
Right.
Okay. Why? I take it you don't need the money?
We don't need the money.
Okay. My understanding, Jim, and I have to check on this to make sure, is that it is possible to do it. Have you checked with the investment firm yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Is an estate planning attorney handling this for you and your brother, or are you guys trying to do it yourselves?
At the moment, we're trying to do it ourselves.
Okay. Do you have an estate planning attorney in mind, someone who may be able to help you with it?
No, I don't.
Okay. You can go to avvo.com, avvo.com, or check with the investment firm and see if they can recommend an estate planning attorney in your area as well. And see if they can, it's called a disclaimer, and it is possible to do it, but there are some arcane tools that you have to use to have it set up. Usually it's better if you can actually have it pre-established that it's possible to do it as part of the beneficiary, but I think you should be able to do it based on what you're saying.
Yeah. Good luck, Jim, and sorry for your loss. Lynn in Racine is with us now. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, King Kevin. here's my situation. I have a 98-year-old mother who is still living in her own home, but she has hospice care, and we have a paid caregiver plus family members. We're doing tag team here. I am looking at her funds. Right now, we're okay, but probably within the next year, aren't I optimistic? Mm-hmm. Within the next year, we are going to need to draw either from her annuity or from a CD, because I messed up when the CD came due last year. I didn't catch it. And so now it has renewed for 2 years. And, of course, there would be a penalty if I took it out, took money out early. So my question is it better to start to annuitize, or should I take out, like you said with one of the previous callers, take out a small amount, say, from the CD and not be taxed on, it's about $100,000 in the CD. Mm-hmm. And she's got about $275,000 in the annuity.
Okay. And I'm glad you asked about this. And as you can tell, Joy, this is a very common situation with a lot of our listeners who this is something that's not in the retirement brochure that, the kids are out of the house or you're financially independent or whatever. And, by the way, you have this 95-year-old to care for and watch over for. And it's becoming a bigger issue, and it will. So we're going to be talking about this forever. Good for you, Lynn, that you at least have the funds available to pay for what you can, and then also the support team, as you will, the tag team. When you talk about annuitizing the annuity, that's not the only option, right? You also have an option of just taking some money out, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But if you take it out, it's going to be taxed at your mother's income tax bracket, right?
Right.
Okay.
It's her CD, it's her annuity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then would you guess that if she were to pass away or when she passes away and the annuity is there, would you guess that you and your siblings would, first of all, inherit the money and, second of all, probably be in a higher tax bracket than what she is in right now?
Part of us might be.
Okay. All right. Well, here's what I'd recommend. I'd recommend you take some out of the annuity to the extent that you can avoid taxation on it. Because she doesn't have a lot of other income, right? She probably just has Social Security.
Social Security and a pension, yeah.
Okay. Is the pension significant? Is it more than the Social Security?
Between the Social Security, no, it's less than the Social Security. Monthly income from those two things would be about $1,800 a month.
Okay, so she's in a very low income tax bracket. Therefore, you can probably take some money out of the annuity and pay little or no taxes on it. And that'll be a benefit not only to her, which is the most important concern, but also to you and your siblings, because otherwise, if she dies and then you inherit the annuity, you might have to pull it out and pay a higher tax bracket on it than she will right now. So what I'd like to see you do is pull out some from the annuity every month or once a year, whatever, to the point where she can stay below the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket. And that's probably, I'd say about maybe $2,500 a month that she could pull out of that and not get taxed too heavily on it. Then don't worry about the penalty on the CD. Have you checked to see what the penalty actually is?
Well, if I took the whole thing out, it would be about
$3,000.
$3,000. Right now. Now, I'm wondering if, the longer I wait closer to the maturity date, then I would think it would be less?
Yep, it should be less. Usually what they'll do is they'll say it's a penalty in terms of months' worth of interest, meaning if
that's
you take it out now, it's 6 months' worth of interest or a year's worth of interest. So the plan that I would use is to take a sum out of the annuity now, let the CD keep rolling, and then and only when you actually need it, take out just what you need, because usually they will only penalize you on whatever you withdraw. So if you withdraw say $10,000, it would just be a $300 penalty. And because the interest rate is probably extremely low, losing a month's or 6 months or whatever worth of interest isn't going to be a big penalty anyway. So don't beat yourself up about missing out on that. It was probably the right thing to do anyway, because you're at least going to earn some interest on it. But take some from the annuity now and then switch over to the CD after you've withdrawn probably about $30,000 or so from the annuity.
Now, okay, so then once you start withdrawing from the annuity, you're not obligated to continue every month the same amount?
Yep, not if you don't annuitize it. Annuitizing it says, hey, we're going to start sending you a payment every single month on the same day for a certain period of time. It might be your mother's life. It might be 10 years. You get to decide usually what it is. But you can also just take a certain portion of that out as you need it. The bad news is when you take that little portion out at your own discretion, it's all taxable as income until you get down to the cost basis of the annuity. Whereas if you were to annuitize it, part of each payment is taxable as interest, and part of it is return of your principal and is tax-free. But it's a big risk to take, because now you can't get access to that really large chunk of money. It's a much bigger portion of her assets than the CD. I wouldn't want to give that up just to save a little bit in taxes.
Thank you for the call, Lynn. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley. Irvin in Burnett is with us.
Yes, I always enjoy listening to your show. Get some good tips on financial advice. And you were just talking about annuities, and I have a non-qualified tax-deferred annuity. And when you take money out of it, is the principal amount that you put in also taxable, or to your heirs if you when you pass away, or is it just the tax-deferred interest that's taxable?
Thank you for your kind words, Irvin, and good news. It's the interest first as you withdraw it is taxable as ordinary income. Once you get all the way through that, then you get to pull your principal out, and there's no taxation on that whatsoever. And again, you're talking, Irvin, probably about just pulling it out as you see fit, or are you talking about actually annuitizing where you take a guaranteed monthly payment every month?
Well, I haven't touched it, and I really don't need the money, and I was just kind of leaving it there for the children.
Okay. Now, that brings up a related subject to our previous caller. If your children are in a higher tax bracket for them, it's nice that you're leaving for them, but if they're in a higher tax bracket than you are, then you're actually going to end up paying more taxes as a family than you would if you were to just take a small amount out every single year, pay little or nothing in taxes on it, and then leave the cash to the kids.
Yeah, I understand that, but I was just wondering about if the principal amount that I'd paid in was also taxable.
Not taxable at all.
That's what I kind of thought, but it kind of sounded like it might be the way you phrased it.
Nope, it's only they qualify your withdrawals first as interest and income, and then it's taxable as ordinary income. But after you withdraw all of the earnings on it, then there's no taxation on the rest.
Thank you, Irvin, for the call and your kind words. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. It is time now for Smart Assets. As the last chapter on our series of socially responsible investing concludes, we will take a look at a way to invest in the slow money movement. So, Kevin, what is the slow money movement?
Well, it comes, it's kind of a derivative of the phrase of slow food, which is supposedly the opposite of fast food. And it's based on a book by a guy named Woody Tesh. And it talks about keeping money local and trying to keep it circulating in your own community rather than passing it on to other locales. And when it comes to food, it talks about seeking returns and goals that hopefully are profitable for you, but that's not the only goal.
Yeah, so what kinds of actions are included in this philosophy?
Well, as you might imagine, it talks a lot about supporting local and sustainable agricultural growers and producers and distributors. Through their website, they've actually set up about $50 million that's been invested in 519 different organizations. They funded startups. They fund up smaller restaurants that need help, local and organic growers. And it could be as simple as just joining a CSA and for community-supported agriculture, where you kind of have a subscription service of food, so the farmer has more ability to predict how much revenue is coming in, and you have an ability to support that farmer's methods for it. And then even when you're just shopping around, it's about buying from local suppliers or even picking up stuff at the farmer's market.
So what would be slow money supporters keep in mind when considering investing in this type of thing?
Well, your profits probably shouldn't be your first goal or your only goal, and there may be better risk-reward offerings from traditional investments like stock mutual funds, bond mutual funds, etc. You shouldn't invest anything into any of these kind of entities that you can't afford to lose, because although they may be very profitable investments, they're still investments in businesses, and a lot of times there can be a gray area where it goes between an investment and a donation. So you have to keep in mind that this isn't something that you should expect to live off of the interest or the profits. And if you do put a significant amount of money into these types of investments, you want to make your other ones probably a little bit more conservative, so that if something happens with this more aggressive investment, that it doesn't damage your own financial security. And keep in mind that money isn't the only thing you have to offer to these kinds of causes or any other charity. People also need you to volunteer your time, your expertise, or your advocacy in terms of promoting them on social media or with your other friends.
So where can listeners get more info on the slow money movement?
Well, the website based on the book is at slowmoney.org, and there are also other kinds of investment opportunities for you to invest in organic farms and other types of agricultural operations. IroquoisValleyFarms.com. Farmland LP is a limited partnership, farmlandlp.com. And in some of these, we had a gentleman call before saying he wanted to start organic farming, but he didn't know where to get the money to do it. Well, actually, many of these institutions, particularly the Iroquois Valley Farms, actually have a program called their Young Farmer Program, where they seek out people who are willing to do the work, and they'll help them get the financing they need to get started. Again, we'll have all of these websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And speaking of food, we will, coming up in our Shop Around segment, take a look at meal delivery plans and whether they are worth the cost. That's coming up on this edition of On Your Money. If you have a question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, our number is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kim in Eau Claire is with us now. Hi, Kim.
Hello. Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin. I have a TSP, a thrift savings account. I'm looking at probably retiring a year from this June. Now, I pulled out of the market because of the volatility, and I kind of kicked myself. Anyhow, when I retire, the charges on that TSP account are very low. Would you suggest possibly rolling it or leaving it in there? I can play within it as far as being in the market or being in bonds. What would you suggest?
Well, it's hard to give out investment advice on this, Kim, without delving more into your situation, and probably more than you'd want us to. But when you say TSP, you're talking about the thrift savings plan available to government employees, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, it's a nice plan. It's very low cost. They have limited fund options, so there's probably half dozen or so that you can use. They have one in there that you can't get anywhere else, and there's like a fixed account in there, right?
Yes, that's what I'm in right now. It's just a bond. It's government bonds totally, and it's very low risk, but the yield is very low also.
Right, and that usually is commensurate with any kind of investing. The risk and the reward are usually equal to each other, the potential risk and reward anyway. If it were me, I'd probably keep enough in there to always have access to that fixed account, because what is that paying right now? You mentioned it was low, but do you know what the actual rate is?
I was getting under 1%, 9.8% over per month. I check it every month to see, but it's quite low. I mean, there's over 300,000 in the account, so I mean it does, and I'm still adding to it, you know, now because I'm still working.
Right.
I've been putting 11% in there for 25 years. So.
Okay. Good for you. I would leave it in there, especially while you're still working. You can always roll it over at any point down the future, but you can't usually go back into it. And if you do, you can't get something that's quite like that fixed account. That you're right. That rate is not very attractive, especially when you compare it to other relatively safe investment options like longer-term CDs. But I wouldn't change it for that. And in terms of the investing, you know, you have to keep in mind a couple of things, one of which is anytime you're in a stock investment account, that can go down 30 or 40 or 50% in a given year. And that's the price you pay for the potential long-term greater gain than this safe fixed account. Some people, though, this happens a lot when people come to me in my grown-up job and my day job, and they say, I want you to look at my situation and see if I can retire. It turns out that they have enough money where they could actually bury all their money in the hole in the ground and take out a little bit from that hole every month, and it would last at least as long as they're likely to last. Therefore, it's very difficult to advocate them taking lots of risk to get a reward that they don't actually need. So look at your spending. Look at you're probably going to get a Social Security, maybe a pension. And if you do, you might have enough set up to say, gee, I've got enough coming in. Why would I take a bunch of risk of losing a bunch of money because I don't actually need the reward in the first place? Especially after we've had basically an 8-year run-up in the economy, an 8-year run-up in the stock market, and we have the Federal Reserve likely raising interest rates going forward. All those things lead me to believe that the returns over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years probably aren't going to be as good as they have been over the last period of those periods in the past.
Thank you, Kim. Dick in Monroe is with us now. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my question. I have recently come into an inheritance. I'm in my mid-60s. I'm well-suited for retirement, although I'm not retired, and so I really don't need the money. But, you know, based on the volatility that we see in the market and the run-up that we've recently had, what would you suggest as an investment strategy for that? Right now it's sitting in cash and, you know, money market accounts, and it's not getting very much income, and would be interested in your advice on how to invest that.
Sure, that's a good question, Dick. And again, it's difficult to do it in 30 seconds, but if you don't need the risk and you don't need the reward, you don't want the risk, keeping it safe is a good idea. And again, especially at these points, if you want to try to at least maximize your return without taking a lot of risk, look at certificates of deposit and go out as long as you can stand it, knowing what the penalty for early withdrawals. You know, if you go out with a 5-year CD, you're probably going to get close to 2%, and you may have a penalty for early withdrawal of 6 months to a year's worth of interest. Well, for me, that's a good price to pay for something that, where, like you say, you're well situated. You just as soon not lose the money. A lot of people who are too aggressively invested right now are not going to find that out until they actually lose the money, and they're going to say, "Gosh, I was closer to retirement now than I've ever been, and lo and behold, I lost several $100,000 from my account. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to get it back, and now I'm retiring and I need to start spending it, so I can't keep it invested to try to earn that money back that I lost." You know, people, if they have, let's say they have $500,000 in a retirement account, if that drops down to $300,000, no one says, "Well, at least we still have $300,000. Everyone says, "We lost $200,000, and the pain of losing that money is often greater than the pain of missing out on greater growth.
Thanks, Dick, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. and we welcome your personal finance questions for him during this edition of On Your Money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And in this edition of Shop Around, we are finishing up our series on eating better in the new year with a look at meal delivery plans. I want one. How do these work, Kevin?
Well, you sign up or you subscribe to a service, promise to pay every single month or every single meal, and then you get the meaty ingredients of a particular recipe sent to you along with instructions on how to prepare it. You make it, you eat it, and according to the publication Packaged Facts, there are about 150 services that offer this feature right now in the United States. It's expected to generate about $1.5 billion in sales in 2016, and it should have even more growth in the future. Many restaurants and supermarkets are going to be getting into the business as well.
So I have to make it. So what's the attraction of these services?
Well, it's still convenience. A lot of people who use these like the fact that they don't have to go to the store. They don't have to go up and down the aisle. That can take a good 2 hours depending on your time frame. And having to think about a meal plan every single night, say, okay, what am I going to have? I want something interesting, but I don't want to have to think about it. And I just want it to show up on my front door. It's actually much less expensive than dining out, and you get greater portion control because you get to decide what you want to eat and eat it later. And it's probably a little fresher and more predictable than just getting takeout money. And because you are only getting certain amounts, like you don't have to go and buy entire bottle of, let's say, chopped garlic or a lemongrass stalk or something. It's a smaller portion, and therefore you're probably spending less money because you're not buying these things that only come in a larger size than what you need.
And they do look tasty. I've seen some ads for them, but what's the downside?
Well, the downside is you still need to have some ingredients and utensils on hand, the basic. You have to know how to do it. Then there's the time to cook it. A lot of people who choose this do this so that they'll have more time to maybe spend with their family or just relax after work. And you still have to spend half an hour to an hour cooking it and preparing it ever. And then there are the issues of the delivery in terms of timing it. How long is it going to sit out on your front porch?
Right.
There's a very narrow temperature range that you can get that keeps things fresh but doesn't freeze it, especially at this time of the year. And there's a lot of packaging. You know, they have to keep all these ingredients separate so they don't mix until you add them all together. And these boxes can be huge for just a couple of small meals. Cost per meal is not too bad. It's about twice what you'd pay if you were to buy the ingredients on your own. And then finally, there are the subscription issues. You kind of have to manage the subscription so that if you're going to be gone for a week or you don't want it, for whatever reason, you have to cancel it. And if you don't cancel it, something might end up on your doorstep that you still have to pay for. But you're right. It is a way to eat healthier. It's a low-risk way to try new items that you otherwise wouldn't think about doing. And then once you find something that you a dish that you like, you get to keep the recipe. So you can say, okay, I'm going to put this one in my file. I'm not going to pay for it anymore. I'm going to go out and get the ingredients on my own.
So any plans that stand out to you?
Most follow the same model. Some of the biggest ones are Blue Apron, HelloFresh, and Green Chef. Consumer Reports says that HelloFresh and Green Chef were the top-rated ones in their study. Plated was the one that tasted the best, and Blue Apron was the low cost. But the great thing about these is it's such a competitive market right now. They are giving away lots of free trial subscriptions to this, so you can go in and sign up for a couple weeks worth of meals maybe to see if you like it. Sometimes you have to enter a credit card in, so make sure if you don't like it, you cancel the credit card payment. Or you can talk to people. You know, a lot of these people who are doing it already want to go on and on about it. Many times there's a referral system where if you use them as a referral for it, you can get a discount for it as well. But try them out what you like. You'll either love it or you can say, nope, we're going to go back to just the drudging through the aisles at the supermarket.
If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there's still time for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tom in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
My question is, I keep hearing about Social Security, and what most investors say to hold off until 65, 66, 70. Don't draw at 62. My question is, it's kind of a double-sided question. I've done the numbers, and I would have to, if I didn't draw at 62, and I waited to 65, I would almost have to be 80 years old before I'd start losing money on that way of drawing it. So that's my first question. Then to roll it up into my plan financially, and I know he needs to know my finances exactly, but I wanted to draw my Social Security at 62 while I'm drawing my pension, and then any extra money that I would need, I would then draw out of my Roth IRA, 401k, or money that I've already paid taxes on to stay in the 15% tax bracket. I'll wait and listen.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, then I'll answer. Tom, it's a really good point, and you've obviously done your homework on it, and most people who do arrive at the same conclusion. They say, well, wait a minute. Yes, I'm getting a higher check for every year that I wait, usually about 7 or 8% higher than what I'd get if I were to take it today. But I'm giving up a year's worth of checks for every year that I wait for only a slightly higher check. And therefore, I have to live a long time and collect these checks for a long time to make up for that lost year, which is much bigger than that small increase. And you're correct. It's usually about 78 to 80 is the break-even age. And most people listening to this show are going to live longer than that. But still, the median age at which people take Social Security and retirement is about 63, meaning half take it sooner than that and half take it later. Well, for most people, they can't even take it until 62. So by the time the first year elapses, half the people who are eligible have already taken it. You're in a luxury if you can wait to take it. If you have extra savings or income, you don't need it. It's a nice thing to do. But most people would rather hang on to their savings and investments and not deplete that for something that is promised to be down the road. I had a client who many years ago came to me and said, what's the cost of taking Social Security now at 62 versus waiting? And I ran the spreadsheets and did the numbers and everything. I said, well, you'd probably make about maybe $150,000 more if you waited till 70. He said, great. And then he went out and took it the next day at age 62. And I said, it's your money. You can do with it what you want. But why did you choose to take it after I showed you the difference? He said, well, I just wanted to know what it was. But he said, I just gave up a significant paycheck that I was earning while I was working. I've been told my whole life Social Security is not going to be there when I retire. I've been to lots of funerals for people not only younger than 80, but younger than 62. And so I'm just going to take this. And that's what I'm going to choose to live off of. And then I'll have my money around for bigger expenses, to supplement Social Security, to help my kids out, to give to charity, to invest in other places, whatever, and I like the flexibility of it. And for him, that was the right decision.
Yeah. I'm with him. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Let's go to Vicki in Gilmantown. Gilmantown, Vicki?
Gilmanton.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Vicki, go ahead with your question.
I have a question. I have some money in a retirement account. I wish to take it out. And I don't know if I can do that without taking a hit tax-wise.
Yeah, Vicki, my best friend grew up in Gilmanton, so I know that town very well. I'm serious. You would actually know him because there was a big barn right in town that his grandfather owned, and when you drove by it, his last name was on that barn, so you know who I'm talking about, don't you?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Okay, Vicki, so how old are you?
67.
67. Okay. So you want to take that money out of the 401k just to live off it, or you don't like it in the account anymore, or what are your thoughts?
I don't like it. I do not need it to live. I'm worried about it.
You're worried about it. Okay. You're worried about the money.
I'm worried about the future.
Sure. Yeah, join the club. There's a way, Vicki, that you can have that 401k that you can roll it over to what's your favorite bank or credit union? Is it the Bank of Wamandi, or which one is it?
Well, right now I'm in United Bank in Mendovi.
Okay, very fine bank. You can move it into an IRA there, tax-free, and they will invest it just like it's a CD. They'll give you not very much, 1 or 2% maybe for a longer-term CD, but it's tax-free when it's rolled over from the IRA to, or from the 401k to the IRA, and then it's safe. And you can still get access to it whenever you want. The bank will help you fill out the forms and make the transfer for it. But when you roll it over there, it still stays tax-deferred, but now you have a CD. Now, if you just want the money, you can take it out and do with it what you want, put it in your checking account. But I would at least suggest you take some of it out in 2017 and the rest out in 2018 so that you spread the tax hit out between 2 years, and hopefully then your overall tax rate will be lower than it if you were just to take out a big lump sum right away.
Thanks, Ricky, for the call. Let's go to Marcia in Hayward now. Hi, Marcia.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a question concerning assets and accounts that are taxed after I die to my, you know, child. Are IRAs, CDs, savings accounts, life insurance, house, stock, annuities, what will be taxed and what will be tax-free to him?
The only thing that will be taxed, Marcia, are those annuities and the IRAs that you have, and that's only when they're taken out after your death. They're just taxed as ordinary income, and there are different rules about the different accounts as to when the money has to be taken out after death. Otherwise, just about everything else will be tax-free. The estate tax exemption right now means that people can die with estates that are about $5.5 million before any estate tax kicks in, and then it is only on the money above that $5.5 million amount. That's the only amount that's taxed. So estate taxes have almost disappeared from our society unless you're in the 1% of the 1%. So they'll only pay taxes on assets that you would otherwise have to pay taxes on anyway, like IRAs and annuities. It's a question of if their bracket's going to be higher than yours is. And if it is, you might want to take some out now and then just leave the cash to them so that they don't have to pay more taxes on it than you would today.
But they do not, he won't pay on CD.
Nope, not if it's in an account like a just a regular CD account. It's not in an IRA. Then no, they don't pay any taxes on that.
Thank you, Marcia. David in Madison is with us. Hi, David.
Hello. My question is: currently, I have a traditional 401k with about $40,000 from my previous employer. I'm 29 years old. I'm currently the 401k is sitting in a money market. I was a little bit scared with the volatility of the market, and I left it like that about 6 months ago. Right now, I'm thinking about moving it to a UW or one of the local credit unions because I want to maybe use some of the money to put for a down payment for my first house. I understand there's no penalties by using that for a house. I do will have to pay taxes. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Hey, how much do you think you'd be taking out, David, from the 401k for a house?
I would like to put 20% down so I can avoid my what's called a PIM or whatever the insurance it is. Mm-hmm. Maybe 20 or 25,000.
The PMI, private mortgage insurance, right? Yeah, that's a good idea to avoid that if you can. But here's the thing: you said it's in a 401k right now, right?
Yes.
Okay, but it's your former employer, correct?
Correct.
Okay. The 401k, it's sometimes nicer to preserve even if it's your from a previous employer. If you were currently working there and you were buying a house, you could actually borrow money from it possibly and use that as the down payment for it. But you can't because you're not working there anymore. However, if it's in a 401k and you need the money for between 55 and 59 and a half, you can pull it out of the 401k with no penalty. It will be taxed as income. With an IRA, though, you'll generally have to expect to pay both penalties and taxes on it until you're 59 and a half. So if you're going to move it into an IRA, you might want to just move the portion into the IRA that that you plan on using to pay for the house. And I would use as little as you possibly can stand, because what you'll find, David, is that the PMI expenses are actually going going to be less than the taxes on it, and especially the quicker you can get that to the 20% status on the loan to value ratio. So only get to that 20% level if you absolutely have to, and only take out enough just to pay the taxes and to get to the 20% level. Otherwise, I think that's a good plan.
Thank you, David. We need to get to the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we've been talking a lot about food lately and ingredients and shopping, and you can go to allrecipes.com, and they have not only a ton of recipes, but they also have a search engine where you can add in ingredients that you have on hand, and it will kick back a bunch of recipes that qualify for that, and then you can pick the ones without having to go out and shop for anything else. Allrecipes.com, and again, we'll have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us most every Tuesday at this time for the live broadcast of On Your Money. The program is rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.